WBTV's Good Question is a member of the Queen City Podcast Network. Listen to your city at queencitypodcastnetwork.com.
In this episode, we're hearing from Dena King, the first person of color to serve as the top prosecutor for the Western District of North Carolina. She now leads an office of approximately 100 federal prosecutors and staff located in Charlotte and in Asheville. That office serves over 3 million residents throughout North Carolina. Last year, she was nominated by President Joe Biden for the position. She was then sworn in by the United States Senate. She grew up right here in Charlotte and graduated from South Mecklenburg High School. Our Jamie Bowl got a chance to ask her about the milestone moment in her life, overcoming tragedy at a young age, as well as her thoughts on gun violence and drug trafficking.
Dena, it is wonderful to meet you. Thanks for making time to talk to us.
Great meeting you as well. Thank you.
Tell me about Dena King at South Meck High School. What was that young woman like?
So I was involved in an assortment of student activities, and I didn't know how to just be a member. I had to be in some type of leadership position in the clubs. I was involved in NAACP, in the marching band. I played the flute. Mm-hmm. I also played in the concert band. I was a part of an organization called Sisters with Vision that was a female-based organization where we would get together and discuss our lifelong plans. Mm. Beta Club, Inner Key. I was also voted most likely to succeed by my peers.
And there what was it about those things, like leadership things and groups that just sort of pushed you in that direction? Why did you want to do that?
I gravitated to being a peer leader. I think I had the personality where many of my peers enjoyed being around me. Mm-hmm. And so it was a natural fit for me to kind of be a student leader. Once I would join the various organizations, people would look up and say, okay, well, we need a president or we need a vice president. And I'm just sitting back and they're like, Dena King, you're going to be our president or you're going to be our vice president. And so at that time, I just became a natural leader. Also had the opportunity to be a part of student government while in high school. And so I served sophomore class, junior class, as well as senior year as a part of our executive council. And so representing my entire peers in terms of the school at that level was great.
How did CMS prepare you, for a career going forward?
CMS actually taught me and helped develop my leadership skills at a very young age. It taught me how to be around my peers and not be afraid to stand up, but also how to advocate to adults. At that time, especially while I was a part of student government, there were times that we would be advocating for different things on behalf of all of the students. So for an example, maybe we want pizza to come for lunch. And so we needed someone to be the spokesperson to say that we need pizza, an outside vendor to come in and serve this. And so being able to be that leader, to stand up for all of my peers, but also to advocate in front of adults was really, really rewarding.
That takes some nerve and some guts to do those sorts of things. Where did that come from?
So I was instilled at a very young age by my parents to be all that I could be the best me that I could be. And they taught me that the sky was not the limit. And so I had a very traumatic event. You've probably maybe heard me talk about it before. At a very young age, my brother died tragically in a car accident a few days before Christmas. He was 15 years old at the time. I was the younger sister. I was 13 years old. 10 months after that, my father, who really mourned having to bury a child, died unexpectedly of a heart attack. I like to say my dad died of an actual broken heart. Mm. And so in a matter of 10 months, my four-person family that we were used to having four dinner plates set at a table was diminished down to two. Mm. And so now, there took a couple of months. I'm still setting place settings for everyone, and there's only two people left at the table, my mother and I. And so my parents had instilled that in me, but I think after my father and my brother died, it sparked something within me to really try to pursue my dreams. They knew I wanted to be an attorney. They pushed me to do that. In fact, I joke all the time and say that I was the smartest girl on earth in the eyes of my father and my brother. They were my protectors. And so when they died, it really put something in me to really, really try to do my best. They died around the time that I was attending high school. And so one of the ways that I dealt with grief, which that was the first time I'd ever experienced grief, but one of the ways that I dealt with grief was by being busy. Mm. Being involved in so many extracurricular activities allowed me to kind of keep my mind off of that, but then it allowed me to pursue my dreams. And in doing that, I kind of saw, well, I'm a pretty good leader. At least people are kind of listening to me, so that works out pretty well. And it then prepared me for this lifelong career to be a leader.
What grade were you in?
At the time that my brother died, I was in eighth grade at Quail Hollow Middle School. And my father died that next semester, so it was September of 95, and I was a freshman in high school at South Mecklenburg.
Do you ever give yourself a second to think? Because when things like that happen in one's life, you can kind of go different ways, right? One of
Absolutely.
Two ways.
Absolutely.
And obviously, you chose a positive path out of that. That's not always easy, though, is it?
It's not. And looking back, and I think that's part of the reason that I've been more vocal about sharing this story now. For years, I wouldn't talk about it, primarily because I would get emotional. And it was just easier for me to suppress it. But now that I'm in this role, it's really helpful for people to understand my life has not been easy. I've had significant obstacles I've had to overcome. I now can say I came from a single parent family. I've spent more life now with just one person, person, my mother in the home than I have as a two parent home. And so yes, I had that moment where I was stuck at what do I do? Do I stay in my bedroom and continue to cry my eyes out? Or do I live a life that honors their name and honors their legacy? And so I chose to honor their legacy in everything that I do.
It's a powerful message, really, for anyone who's dealt with pain, you know, in, in their life. And that's why you kind of like to share that when you can.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Sharing it so that people will understand that you too can overcome. I think we're dealing in a time where people are in fact experiencing a lot of loss and a lot of devastation. And there are people that just simply don't know how to overcome, or they don't know whether or not it's possible to overcome. So me being able to share that story, there have been times that I've opened up and shared it with people, and people have told me, oh, well, I lost a loved one, or I lost this, or, and I didn't know that we shared that thing in common, but being able to be vocal about that, I think helps someone else to know that they too can overcome.
What was it about the law that sort of had you gravitating in that direction?
So admittedly, I was infatuated with the concept of becoming a lawyer. I first saw a lawyer on TV, and that was Claire Huxtable. And so I said I wanted to be like Claire Huxtable. I, at the time, did not know what it took to be an attorney. I certainly did not know that I would need to go to law school and pass the bar at that age. I did not know that. I simply wanted to be an attorney. And the more I researched and the more I learned, and definitely while being in law school, having the opportunity to participate in trial team, I soon decided, yeah, this is exactly what I want to do. And so I think because of that experience, that's one of the reasons that being a role model for others is so important for me. I didn't really have a role model that could teach me the ins and outs about the requirements for becoming an attorney. I had to read about it. And it was the path wasn't always easy. You know, I had to figure things out on my own. But being able to be a live role model for someone to help them along the way, especially those people that might be interested in pursuing a profession in the law, I think is really impactful. When I think about role models and what they mean to people, I sometimes think about the analogy of a paper map versus a GPS.
Yeah.
With a paper map, you know, you'll eventually get to your destination. Sometimes you may take the longer route to get there. You may take a few wrong turns. But by having a GPS, it's giving you the step-by-step directions. It's navigating you and pivoting you and even telling you pitfalls that are ahead. I want to be someone's GPS. I want to be their live role model so that young people will understand that careers that they thought they could not reach, they actually can reach those careers.
Was it by accident or that you mentioned Claire Huxtable, a black woman, obviously, in the legal profession? A fictional character, sure.
Absolutely.
But there was representation at least to be seen on the screen. Did
that is
correct. Have an impact?
That had a tremendous impact. You know, thinking back again, it was during a time where you didn't see a whole lot of women in professional careers. And so it was a time where, as a young girl, I was somewhat being taught you either choose to have a family or you choose to have a professional career. Well, Claire Huxtable had both. She was a mother, she was a wife, and she had this professional career. So she was by far the first African-American character that I saw that in my eyes had it all. And so as a very young child, I said, well, I want to be like Claire.
Yeah.
I want to have it all. I want to have this thriving career, but I also want to have a family, and I don't want to sacrifice either. And so I then began to mimic myself after this fictional character. And now looking back, I'm thinking, wow, how unbelievable could I be to some young lady, especially a little young girl of color?
That's what I was going to ask you about, because now here's the real life story.
Absolutely.
Of Claire Huxtable.
Absolutely.
Right? Does that come with a burden? How do you view it?
I think it comes with not a burden, but it definitely comes with a sense of responsibility. Mm. I've been placed in this position. I earned it, but I've been placed in this position where there are a lot of young me's mm-hmm. that are looking up to me. They're looking up to me for guidance, but they're also looking up to me in the way that I carry myself, the things that I say, the things that I do, how engaged I am in and outside of the office. And so I think that's really important. You know, so often we tell kids, be all that you can be. But kids need to see someone in the shoes of mm-hmm. what they want to be for them to know that it's a reality.
Could you have believed, even back in law school, here we are now in 2022 with a black woman as vice president. We're about to have a black woman be on the United States Supreme Court. And now you hold this job here. Could you have envisioned that even those years ago when you were in law school?
I could envision it simply because I've always known that women will lead. Mm-hmm. And so I could envision it to see the warm embrace of the community is what it brings me so much joy. I think we're living in a time now where the community is in fact embracing the concept that women of color can in fact lead. And so that's just a remarkable feeling.
Did you realize at the time when you were nominated for this position that you would be a first?
I did not at all. I did not realize I would be the first at all. In fact, it was closer towards the time that I was rounding the nomination process that I learned that I would be the first. And so I'm incredibly honored to be the first, but also hope that I'm the first of many. And mm-hmm. so making sure that I am intentional about letting people know about this as a career path. Many people don't understand the joys and benefits of having a career path in public service. And so helping them to understand that, but also helping people of color to understand the career path of being prosecutors, because I think there's a lot we can do on this side.
I wanted to ask you about that. How did you get to that path as opposed to say being, you know, a defense attorney or something like that, or even going into the private sector?
Absolutely. So while at North Carolina Central Law School, I had the opportunity to intern at the Public Defender's Office. Mm-hmm. And while I was at the Public Defender's Office, I quickly learned that there weren't a lot of minority prosecutors. And so while in law school, I decided I want to change that. And so it was at that moment that I developed my love for criminal law, but decided I wanted to be a prosecutor because I did not see a lot of people that looked like me. Even now, you know, it's no surprise many times when I go in court, the only person that I see that looks like me is the accused. Mm. By having the opportunity to be in the public defender's office, I would a lot of times hear that by people that were accused of crimes. I'm going into court and nobody looks like me. And so I decided to be a prosecutor so that even those that are accused of crimes can come into the courtroom and see at least one other face that looks like them.
Explain more about that, why that's important.
It's important because I think that our criminal justice system, like many systems, has flaws. I think that I have a duty to uphold the law. But in doing that, I want to ensure that communities of color that have oftentimes felt a sense of mistrust by the criminal justice system, they feel a sense of credibility in me. I want to bring credibility to what we do. I want to bridge the gap between the needs of the community and the needs of our law enforcement. And so I care very deeply about our state. I care very deeply about our community, but I want to bring a sense of credibility. As a black woman, especially a black attorney, I know very well some of the flaws that exist within our criminal justice system. So being able to be a part of that change, a catalyst for that change within the system is incredibly important to me.
Which leads us to one of the priorities, obviously, of you in this role is civil rights, right,
yes.
in our community. What does that look like from this office? What does that mean?
Well, I am so happy that you asked that question. For the first time ever in this district, we have implemented a civil rights team. The purpose of this civil rights team is to put civil rights at the forefront of what we do. And when we speak of civil rights, we're thinking of things such as hate crimes, human trafficking, voting rights, disability rights, fair housing and fair lending. And so we have developed a team of individuals within the office that will be not only looking at the prosecution of criminal mm-hmm. civil rights cases, but also the enforcement of civil rights cases. I've designated two federal prosecutors, one to serve as the criminal rights coordinator, and then one to serve as the civil rights coordinator. These individuals, in conjunction with other federal prosecutors, a law enforcement coordinator, and a victim rights coordinator, will be meeting with members of our community where we first educate the community on what civil rights are. Mm. We also provide them with information on how if they believe that they have complaints of civil rights violations, they can have a mechanism to report those complaints to our office. We can work closely with law enforcement proactively in the investigation, especially in cases that involve patterns or practices of discriminatory actions. We can work closely with law enforcement. But then last but certainly not least, to work with businesses and stakeholders to ensure that they understand education and training, and to make sure that they're not engaged in any types of behaviors mm-hmm. that are discriminatory in nature.
This is up and running now?
This is in fact up and running now. What we are working on is developing a specific link on our website, which will feature an explanation about the civil rights team, but also a complaint form where members of the public could literally submit a complaint form directly from our website.
What brought you to this? Why did you think this was necessary in this district to do it?
I think there's not a day that goes by that you don't read something in the paper on a national level about some type of civil rights violation that's occurred. So I think it's one, just quite honestly, a national initiative. I'm not foolish enough to think that it doesn't happen in our district. I think part of what we want to do is engage with the community so that the community, one, knows what their rights are, knows how to adequately designate or see when a violation has occurred, but three, knows where to go. I think so often people feel like their rights have been violated, but they don't even know what the next step mm-hmm. is. And so being able to educate people and give them the tools that they need, because my ultimate goal is to have a community where we're all safe and we all have a right to live, work, and play in our communities.
Does this also include monitoring police work and how that's being handled in our area?
Absolutely. It's accountability from both spectrums, from the perspective of community members and individuals within our community, but also people within our law enforcement community.
Is there a particular concern that you have that really bubbles up to the top out of all of this?
No, there's not a particular concern, just making sure that we address any issues before they rise to the level of being concerns.
For those who might wonder, you know, obviously crime and those kinds of things, you live in this community, you know, as you've pointed out, pretty much your whole life, right?
Yes.
This is where your roots are and that sort of thing. And when we see stories like a 14-year-old shot and killed and a 14-year-old charged, you know, in a killing, you know, like that. First of all, just your reaction to that as someone who lives in the community.
Everyone should be actually sickened by the thought of that, right? Like I said, my ultimate goal is to have safe communities in whatever that looks like. And our communities are very different. And so the needs across the 32 counties differs whether we're talking about the needs here in Charlotte mm-hmm. or we're talking about the needs in Burnsville, North Carolina. But to hear about the violence, that is one of our priorities, making sure that we adequately address those violence needs throughout the district. Specifically, as it pertains to juvenile violence, I serve on a working group by the Deputy Attorney General, where I'm working with other nominated and confirmed mm-hmm. U.S. attorneys across the nation, where we're looking specifically at that aspect, the juvenile violence, determining what are the drivers of juvenile violence, but more important, what can we do, especially engage with other community groups to deter or decrease some of that juvenile violence.
Yeah, explain that a little bit, because what's the federal role in that? We think of it as a local policing issue on some level, obviously. But where can the federal government be involved in that? Where can the U.S. Attorney's Office be involved?
Absolutely. I think our federal work as a whole has significant involvement on violence as a whole. When you think of something like gun violence, for an example, that problem is way too vast for any one community, any one local law enforcement agency, or any one city to handle on their own. Well, when the federal government comes, we are able to bring a host of stakeholders to the table where we can adequately address those issues collectively and then utilize and maximize all of our resources. And so one of the things that we do, for an example, when we're talking about gun violence as a whole, is we partner very closely with ATF. ATF has different databases and resources such as NIBIN, which is the ability to utilize ballistics and trace and do firearm tracing, where we're then able to connect certain ammunition utilized in one crime and connect it to ammunition or a firearm that was used in another crime. Sometimes those are other violent crimes or murders. And so through the use of NIBIN and ATF's firearm tracing, we've been able to solve a host of violent crimes to include murders that didn't even occur within our district. And so bringing all of those stakeholders to the table together, where we're looking at not just violence in isolation based on individual incidents, but we're looking to see if there are in fact trends and connections to solve a much greater and a much larger problem.
You understand the frustration though, right? In the community, because we talk about these things all the time and we try to get to root causes of it.
Absolutely.
And we ask, where are these kids getting these weapons from to begin with? And it still keeps happening.
Yes. And so the other thing that's really important that my office is doing is engaging in reinstituting a campaign called Think Again. Think Again is gonna be in collaboration with ATF. And it encourages members of our community and our young people to do exactly what we say. Think again. Think. Adults, think before you go and buy that firearm on behalf of someone that's not legally able to buy the firearm, which would be straw purchasing. Adults, think before you just hand off a firearm to a juvenile that wouldn't be able to purchase it. Adults, think before you choose not to adequately store your firearm in your house or your vehicle. Juveniles, think again before you decide to go off and do whatever violent act you're about to engage in. And so there's kind of a two-prong. One of it is the educational piece, but also the crime prevention piece. Specific to juveniles, we are gonna be really engaged with members of our school. Going into the schools, actually talking and meeting with students to help them to understand the importance of making good decisions. To that end, I've already had the opportunity to go back to my alma mater, South Mecklenburg High School. I've had the opportunity to speak to students at West Charlotte High School, and then with students that are in Asheville City and public schools, to help them understand there are consequences to people's actions. And so they need to understand what these consequences are to lend themselves into making healthier decisions on the front end.
You mentioned the ballistics and the searching and trying to track these weapons and those sorts of things. Do we have an issue here in the community of, the president was talking about it today, with ghost guns, with trafficking of weapons? Is that happening here in our community?
So there are in fact ghost guns being found located within our communities. Trafficking guns, I think what you hear the president talk about is no different than what's occurring throughout the nation. And so I think the better we can be as prosecutors, especially partnering really closely with ATF and our other federal law enforcement agencies to minimize those types of crimes in our communities is important.
The other major issue I think a lot of people are thinking about right now, we just had a report again about last week, the fentanyl rise and the deaths that we are seeing here in both Carolinas, for that matter, skyrocketing right now. Why can't we get our arms around this?
And so I think drug trafficking is one of our priorities, especially as it pertains to upper level distributors. Those individuals that are in fact releasing poisons such as fentanyl into our communities. So making sure that we're being very intentional to prosecute those cases, but also using it as an opportunity to educate young people on the dangers of drug use and or abuse is really important.
Where's it coming from in our community? How is it getting here?
It's coming from a host of areas. I think it's coming from international places. It's coming from out of state. Like, there's no one true source of where drugs are coming into our communities. I believe it's coming from a host of different areas.
We just did an interview a week or two back with Homeland Security Investigations, launching a task force at Charlotte Douglas International.
Yes.
Is that a point of emphasis for you? Is that a place to be watching?
We have, in fact, partnered with HSI. They've got a task force, and they have a number of agents. We work a number of cases in collaboration with HSI. It's our ultimate goal in any case, especially any drug case, to work up the chain, right? To figure out where, in fact, that source of supply is so that we can not only just make prosecutions, but we want to dismantle and disrupt entire organizations. And so that's our goal in partnering closely with HSI and DEA for that matter.
What are the biggest challenges prosecuting these kinds of cases, these trafficking cases?
As you can imagine, many of these organizations are tight-knit, well-organized organizations. And so I think so often members of the community don't understand that we're aware of who the people are and we are developing cases on them. You know, sometimes you might read about a seizure on one day and wondering why the feds aren't coming in. That doesn't mean that we're not aware and that we're not working that case. We are very strategic in the manner in which we work our cases and work very closely with law enforcement in the development of those cases.
Do you have enough resources to tackle all these issues that we're talking about?
I think there are shortages everywhere, right? But the goal is to make sure that you're adequately utilizing the resources that you have. And so as it pertains to our office's priorities, the department has a number of priorities. The joy of me being the U.S. attorney is I get to look at all of the national priorities, but also look at the needs of our local community and determine what specifically within our local community should we be prioritizing. And based on the local needs, that's how we and how I've chosen to prioritize civil rights, violent crime, drug trafficking. We're also prioritizing white collar cases. There's been an uptick, for an example, in PPP fraud cases, especially with the onset of the pandemic.
Right.
But also there's been the normal trend of securities fraud and investment fraud cases that we've seen for a number of years. Domestic and foreign terrorism cases. There's no shortage of those types of cases.
Yeah.
Also just flat out civil cases, making sure that we are in fact protecting public dollars. And then last but certainly not least, protecting those members of our vulnerable community, and those include our children.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's been a rise in child pornography cases as people have been home, spending a lot of time on the internet, and making sure that we're adequately prosecuting those cases as well as elder fraud cases. And so, you know, one of the things is our priorities, my office's priorities today may not be the same priorities this time next year.
Mm-hmm.
We are going to continue to engage with members of the law enforcement community as well as members of our community at large to find out what the needs are. And we're going to make sure that the priorities that this office engages in are the priorities that are based on the needs of the community.
You mentioned changing priorities. Your predecessor made it a priority to talk about immigration, you know, a lot. And he said the sheriff here has adopted sanctuary policies that endanger our community. Was he right about that?
I don't know whether or not he was right or wrong. I just know that one of the joys of me taking on this role is I get to look at what are the needs at this time and be able to shift the direction of the office, our focus and our priorities. But also, I'm planning on implementing initiatives that I hope will far exceed my role in this seat, which, like I said, is the creation of the civil rights team.
There was talk at the time, right, there was the detainer issue where Attorney Murray at the time was talking about 200 detainers were not being honored here at the local jail by the sheriff. Is that still an issue?
I've not spoken with Sheriff McFadden about that issue. I've met with Sheriff McFadden and we've talked specifically about how to keep our community safe. That's a conversation that I've had with a number of sheriffs and police chiefs throughout this district. And so in my first 3 months, I've been going around meeting with law enforcement in all of our communities, finding out the specific needs of those communities.
Have any of those processes changed since you've come on board with this, in that people being held that you want them to be held, are they being held like you want them to?
In terms of my office, yes. We, you know, seek detention on a number of cases that we prosecute federally. And at that time, we are talking directly to federal judges and asking that the federal judges actually keep individuals detained. And so we've not had any problems with that.
At least to the question, I think, when things become priorities, as administrations change, priorities change. We know that. That's obvious. Some people might wonder, how does politics play into some of these decisions? And if it's changing from administration to administration, how do I know there's like a faith in this system that it's really just doing the public good?
Right. So one thing that I think people need to understand is that while U.S. attorneys and anyone that's been appointed by a president is in fact that, appointed by a president, confirmed by a Senate, at the point that they take over the role, politics stops there. And so in my office, in the decisions that I make, in the decisions and initiatives that we push forward, Politics does not play into that. Now, obviously, throughout different administrations, initiatives and priorities may change, but that's not necessarily politic related. One of the things that's really important to me, and it's primarily based on some of my previous work, is reentry and rehabilitation. Mm-hmm. And so because I'm passionate and truly believe that after offenders have served their time in prison, they should in fact return to our community and be provided with a host of resources to be successful. That's another initiative that my office is implementing, being able to engage closer with members of the community to ensure that returning citizens have all the tools that they need to be successful.
But are you asked to emphasize or de-emphasize things?
We are provided the national priorities, and we then get discretion to choose from those national priorities which ones we want to highlight based on the needs of our district. Ultimately, every U.S. attorney that sits in this seat, regardless of whom they were nominated or appointed by, has the ultimate goal of wanting to protect communities. The manner in which we do that may be different, but we all have the same goal in mind. And so being able to come into this position and look at how I implement the safety of the communities and what things are important to me in doing that is important. One of the things that's really important to me is community engagement. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of my priorities aren't necessarily just focused on law enforcement engagement. It also consists of law enforcement engagement, primarily because I feel a great sense of responsibility as it relates to the needs and concerns of our community. And so being able to meet with community members and get input from them about what they would like to see, being able to sit down with people that agree with the things that my office does and those that disagree is really important to me. And that's not always done. I think so often we focus on kind of the needs of law enforcement that sometimes we neglect to hear from the community and what would be important to members of the community. And so that's why I'm so intentional in making sure that I'm not only meeting with law enforcement, but I'm also meeting with members of our community.
Let me bring you back full circle. You said you got to go back to South Mac and talk to the students there. What was that like to go back into the building and walk those halls again?
So there are so many halls and buildings at South Mac that literally look the same. And so it was, we talk about homecomings. It was the ultimate homecoming for me. My investiture was held at South Mecklenburg, and to see the looks on the students when they heard about what I had accomplished and to know that I came from South Mac was just, I saw the twinkle in their eyes. And so that was really a humbling experience for me. And it was very early on. And so for me to know that I was able to impact people in that way, let me know that that's something I have to be intentional about throughout my tenure in this role.
Perfect. I appreciate you making time to talk to us. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
WBTV's Good Question is a product of WBTV in cooperation with Queen City Podcast Network and Balto Creative Media. From WBTV, Good Question is produced by Jack Vandertal. Special thanks to Jamie Bull. For the Queen City Podcast Network, WBTV's Good Question is produced by Brian Baltashevitz and Maria Delgado. Production coordinator, Taylor Robinson. It is recorded at the Queen City Podcast Network studios at Advent Coworking in Charlotte, North Carolina.
QueenCityPodcastNetwork.com.